and I hate to keep saying this, but you know, the song is a church, you know, the church, an individual or an individual believer going through a going through a life experience of coming to faith, wanting to stay in the comfort zone, not really wanting to get involved. The Lord steps back and makes it seem like he's not with her. Then she comes back with more fervency, because that's what the whole thing is about. And then eventually she's going to be saying to him, let's go. I want to go right now. And so she becomes, you know, what you can call a mature believer, a mature church. And so last time she had the first experience of the kind of not punishment, but kind of a disciplining, where he disappeared from her and she said, you know, my lover isn't here. Where is he? I hate this. You know, she says, laying in my bed, not our bed, and she can't stand it. So then she finally leaves the comfort zone because she has to go look for him because she hated it. And she goes into the city. And so when we ended up, he's reunited with her, and she says, now, I'm going to hold on to him, and I'm never going to let him go. Because now she knows what it's like to not have him. Just like when you're involved like that with the Lord, and you don't feel his presence for a while, you don't ever want that to happen again. And then when she does come back, you know, they have this thing about you can't be like the gazelles and the does. You know, you don't want to do something that's going to scare her away, and she's going to run away again. You don't want to scare the other people. And, you know, the best example of that is if you have somebody who's too much for people who aren't as involved, they can turn people off and say, well, I don't want to do that. Because we just want to have the chicken dinner, and we want to go to the baseball game, and we want to have the picnic. We don't want to know about all this other stuff. So if you go there and start quoting scriptures, it scares them away. So, because, you know, the does and the gazelles, you know, they'll run off as soon as they get scared. And so then as we ended up with that and she said she's never going to leave him again, procession started that came out of the wilderness. So we ended up with that. The wilderness was a place of testing. It was a place where the people were. It was a place where Jesus was tempted. And now it's a royal procession that's coming out of the smoke, out of a cloud of smoke, which is like the Shekinah glory. And it's surrounded by valiant soldiers that represent security. And it's coming out of the wilderness into the place where there's oases and comfortable stuff. So that's what we're going to start reading now. So, when the bride, and remember, Solomon is writing this, and this is about his actual wife that he's going to marry. One of them. That guy had more wedding albums than most people have. When a woman was on the way to marry a king and there was a wedding procession, it was, of course, a lot of fanfare and it was a whole big thing. So now we're getting close to there's going to be a wedding. Now the procession's coming. And all this stuff, of course, relates to Solomon. So the carriages, you know, when somebody's going to marry the king, they're not gonna just, you know, pull up in some, you know, little Honda or something. It's gonna be like a big thing. So this is kind of what's going on here. So we're gonna start reading. We're still in 3, but we're gonna read starting in verse 9. Because the soldiers are too, they're ready. It says they're ready for battle. They got their swords at their side. And that's another example of spiritual warfare. You always have to be ready. You always have to be. There's never a minute when there's not spiritual warfare. So you always have to have the sword ready. So somebody read 9.
King Solomon made himself the carriage of wood from Lebanon.
So, King Solomon, it says, King Solomon made himself. Okay, now remember, Solomon is the metaphor for Jesus. He's the groom in the story. Solomon's the groom, the Shulamite is the bride. But when we when we advance this to Christ and the church, Solomon made the carriage himself. Now, a king wouldn't make the carriage himself, right? I mean, a king's not going to go out in the garage and start building the thing, because he's going to have people to do that. But Solomon builds it himself. So the king himself makes this carriage, or whatever it is, this royal carriage. So what does that tell you? Jesus himself makes the carriage, right? The one that we're going to sit in, the one that the bride sits in, is made by him. It's not made by anybody else. You get the parallel? Jesus himself is the king. He makes the carriage. And he made the one that we sit in. He did the work. Solomon wouldn't have done the work. He had so many servants, he wouldn't have known what to do with them all. He would have just told 20 or 30 of them, I need this carriage for this new wife I'm getting, and they would have gone and made it. But he made the carriage, and it says he made it out of wood. Okay? This part of it's not made out of gold or silver or anything. It's made out of the wood of Lebanon. Wood represents, wood is much weaker than metal. Yes, wood represents humanity. It represents things that humans do. It represents human work. So he makes it himself. So he had to come into the world as a man and had to die. So he had to do the human work of coming into the world as a human and then physically dying. He physically died. Right? They took him down from the cross and you were walking by. What did you say? That's a dead man. Right? There was no question in anybody's mind he was dead. And he was, in fact, dead. So the human part of it was he did the work through his death. That's the wood. He made it out of wood. The wood from Lebanon, the temple, but all the wood in the temple came from Lebanon, the cedars of Lebanon, which is the most beautiful wood. They floated it down rivers to Jerusalem, and that's what they used in the temple. But then they covered the wood with gold. Everything in the temple was covered with gold. So even though it had a wooden structure, it was covered with gold. So gold and silver, of course, represent God's work, represent God as beautiful and precious and, you know, whatever you want to call it. There's no words to call it. So the wood, which is humanity, is covered by the godliness. So that represents the Messiah. And it also represents us as the bride. Because if you read in Philippians and in Galatians and in Romans, we have no righteousness of our own. We're covered with his righteousness. So it's wood, and it's covered with gold, and it's covered with silver. So isn't that cool? Yeah. So the wood is Jesus' humanity. Okay, now somebody read 10.
Its posts are covered with silver, over it is cloth embroidered with gold. Its cushions are covered with purple cloth, lovingly woven by the men of Jerusalem.
So silver and gold. The support of the thing is gold. Okay, so the bride's not going to fall out of it. It's wood covered with gold. So the carriage is sturdy because it's supported by the power and the wisdom of God, the majesty of God, which is the gold. I mean, this is not something that some guy in Solomon's stable nailed together the night before. And it also represents the faithfulness of redemption because she's safe now inside the thing. When you're redeemed by the cross, you're safe inside the carriage. Right? You're safe. He did the work. Remember, he built it. You don't build your carriage. You don't save, you can't save yourself. If you could go to heaven by being good, or if you could go to heaven by earning something, then Jesus wouldn't have had to go through that horrible death. So he builds the thing. The gold is the faithfulness of the redemption. The chair is wood and it's silver and it's gold. So again, it's human nature, godly nature. It's humanity and it's God. And the whole carriage is that. The whole carriage is the gospel of salvation. And it's made out, it's all made because of love. It puts you in it. If you made your own carriage, it would be a disaster. That's why in, you know, that's why in Hebrews said, well, you know, if the first covenant would have been sufficient, there wouldn't have to be a second covenant. If you could follow the law, then you could earn your way in. You wouldn't have had that a second. You wouldn't have to have a second covenant. But since you can't follow the law and you can't earn your way in, there has to be a better covenant. It doesn't mean that the first covenant was bad. It just means that we can't keep it. So this is a security that's totally provided by the king. And so Solomon here is a, quote, type of Christ, like when we studied the types in the Torah. Like Joseph was one, and, you know, all these things, Moses. Well, David knew he wasn't holy, but he wrote all that stuff about holiness, and he knew what a mess he was. I mean, Peter was a mess. Peter knew he was a mess when he wrote all that stuff in 1st and 2nd Peter about love. And so, verse 11.
Young women of Zion, come out and look at King Solomon. Look at his crown. The crown his mother placed on him on his wedding day. His day of joyful delight.
So, this is evangelization now. You know, the writer's saying, come on, daughters of Zion, let's go see the king. In other words, we gotta go see Jesus now. Let's go see the king. So, it's like, go see the king. Everybody's gotta go see the king. You know, when you encounter Jesus, you don't just say, oh, that was nice. You go tell everybody about it. If you don't, something's wrong. You didn't encounter him. If you keep it to yourself, this business about faith is personal, that's nonsense. Faith is not personal. It's all through the scripture. There's never one place that it says, well, just enjoy your faith and keep it to yourself. And so it's basically, come and see him. He's the king. He's the bridegroom. And you need to come and see him. Just like each person had to go out to get the manna. Each person had to look at the bronze serpent. Each person has to go to the cross. Nobody can go for you. You have to go out and look. Just like when the woman at the well encountered him, the first thing she did was go to the town and say, hey, come and see this guy. When Andrew encountered him, he went and got Peter. He said, come on, we found this guy. When Philip encountered him, he went and got Nathaniel. He said, come on, you got to come and see this guy. Because once you're transformed, then you want everybody to come. You want everybody to know what you know. So, you know, the basis of evangelization is that if you come and see, you can know what I know and be as excited as I am. If you're more worried about your blood pressure, your cholesterol, or your retirement plan, you're never gonna understand it. Right? I mean, how are you gonna understand? If it doesn't supersede everything, then even if you're homeless and living out of a bag, if you're saved, that's better than having money and not be saved. So it's evangelization. And then this thing about the wedding day and the mother, you know, the mother always represents the church. Mother is always the church. You know, God is the father, church is the mother. So we're supposed to come to the knowledge of him through the church. Now that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, inside the physical church building, but through the church, through members of the church, through people who are already on board with this. They're supposed to teach you. Sometimes it happens dramatically, but in general, you have to be taught. And the wedding day is when you finally say, oh, I don't care about my life anymore. I'm surrendered now. Which she's going to do in a minute. And even at the end of the book of Revelation, the last day is called a wedding day. Because then the groom and the bride are united permanently. And all the riffraff who aren't married to him are gone. Unfortunately. Because now everyone is on board with the, oh, Jesus is so nice, and God's done, everything's nice now, and he's going to let everything go. Well, he's not going to let everything go. Every idle word has to be answered for. Have you had a word? Remember, it goes back to when Adam and Eve both had eaten the apple. Why didn't God come and say, oh, just forget about that. That's nothing. That's an apple. Who cares? You know, we'll do something a little more complicated next time. Everything changed because of that. That's why we get sick. So, you know, the church also crowns him as king, because he's king of the church. He's king of the universe. You know, the church acknowledges that. So this business of the mother crowning on the wedding, the mother is the church. And, you know, of course, he has many crowns. We're going to get crowns, but then what does it say in Revelation? When we get, we're going to throw them at his feet. Because you're going to get crowns saying, oh, look at it. You're going to say, oh, I don't deserve any of that. You're going to throw the crowns at his feet. Or at the very end of chapter 3. That was the last verse of chapter 3. And this is the thing, too, where, you know, Paul in Romans and Galatians always talks about there's no boasting. Because you can't boast about anything. Because you didn't do it. If you followed the law perfectly and were saved, then God would have to say, this guy followed every law perfectly, so I'm obliged to save him. Because you would have earned it. And then you'd be allowed to boast. But since nobody's in that position, there is no boasting. There's no boasting in heaven. It's very quiet. So at the end, you know, there's gladness in his heart, because now when the marriage comes, he has his bride, quote, which is all the people that are saved, is the, you know, the church triumphant, all the people that are saved. And, you know, in of course in Romans 8, which, did we do Romans here? Yeah, we did Romans here. So Romans 8, remember he talks about how we're co-heirs with Christ. So, you know, even though we're adopted sons and daughters, we're co-heirs with Christ, who's the real son. So we're co-heirs to all the glory. And that makes him glad. That's what it's all about. It all ends up with, you know, the father gets a family because the son has a bride. The spirit coordinates the bride coming in. You know, it's Trinitarian, of course, but that's the whole plan of salvation is like a marriage. That's pretty exciting. Now we move into chapter 4. Okay, somebody read verse 1. Now this is, chapter 4 has got a whole bunch of weird stuff in it. This is where people get turned off about the book. Go, read 1.
You are beautiful, my beloved. You are beautiful. Your eyes are doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats streaming down the mountains of Gilead.
I've seen some women whose hair looks like a flock of goats. It doesn't sound very appealing to us. Not my wife, of course. That doesn't sound very nice, right? But look what's happening here. See, now the bride's matured. She's gone through a lot now. She's gone through a lot. And she's been tested. And now she understands her redemption. So she saw her redemption. And in these first 5 verses of this, it shows you how Jesus cherishes the bride. And it goes back to Ephesians. In Ephesians 5, you know, he presents the church to show his glory. Because we're not, you know, we're in you know, it's a pure and spotless bride, which we're not pure and spotless. Remember, she's dark like the tents of Kedar. But he keeps telling her how beautiful she is. We're dark because we're sinners. We have all kinds of darkness. You know, nobody can say that they're, quote, holy. I mean, you know, try to be holy. So, you know, none of us are spotless, but yet a pure and spotless bride is provided. So, you know, he cherishes us, and we feel, and when we feel loved, we get stronger, we get more bold. Now the bride feels more loved, so she gets more excited, gets stronger. You know, it's just like, you know, it's just like a relationship with a man and a woman. You know, if you got a relationship of, man and woman who aren't married and they're dating, and the guy says, well, you know, I liked you a lot better yesterday than I liked you today. You know, that doesn't do much to strengthen the relationship. But, you know, if the woman's always saying, oh, I want to be with you, come, oh, I don't want to go home, I want to be with, you know, the guy says, oh, she really wants to be with me. And, you know, the fervor of it makes you stronger. So this is what he does with the bride. And he affirms the bride even in her weakness, even though she's so far still kind of a mess. He affirms her. He affirms us even though we're a mess. Right? Who's not a mess? And so, you know, he kind of sees, like we say, he sees you in your completeness. You know, like Gideon's a good example. Peter's a good example. You know, they were kind of a mess. I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know what I'm... But God says, come on. And, you know, Peter denies Christ 3 times. He's always shooting off his mouth and saying ridiculous stuff. Jesus restores him. And even when he's restored, until Pentecost, he's still a mess. Oh, are you going to restore the kingdom now? What about that guy? He doesn't quite get it. And he thought Jesus was going to restore the kingdom. It was going to be, oh great, this is going to be like David and Solomon. You're going to be the king. We get rid of these Romans. We're going to have a great kingdom. I'm going to probably be the prime minister. This is going to be good. We're all going to have great government jobs because we know the king. They had no idea what really was going to happen. And even down to when he restores him by the Sea of Galilee, even though he lectures him and gives this thing, you know, he sees John out of the corner of his eyes and says, well, what about him? And Jesus says, forget about him. Think about what I just told you. I'd deal with him in his own way. This is what I want you to do. He's doing something different than you. I love that. Well, everybody says that. Why am I doing all this stuff? Look at him. What's he going to do? But then a few chapters before, him and James wanted to call fire down on somebody because they didn't believe him. Let's just blast them. So, the thing is she has now a willing spirit. That's what God wants, is you to be willing and available. Doesn't want you to be perfect. Doesn't want you to, you know, glow and float. Just wants you to be willing to do it. Exactly. And see, the enemy tries to wear you down. Because the enemy says, oh, who do you think you are? Look at you. You think you're serving God? Look what you just did. Look what you just said yesterday. You're a mess. Just forget it. He's always going to try to wear you down. It's going to make you feel worthless. It's going to make you feel ashamed. It's going to bring back stuff you did 20 years ago and say, remember that? Or you're going to run into somebody you knew 30 years ago and he's going to say to you, remember what you said to that guy? So, always a battle. So, we're going to see here that the bride's going to get nourished, and he keeps cherishing her more and more. Look how many times he says, oh, you know, you're beautiful, twice just in that first verse. And, you know, the church feels loved, and then loving him is the radiance of the bride. You know, we can't really love, you know, Jesus said, you know, the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. You know, Peter says, well, I like you. It's basically what Peter says. I like hanging out with you. He says, but do you love me? He goes, I like you a lot. I like you way more than all those other guys. That's the difference in the words. He's saying like, Jesus is saying love. Because it's impossible to process that. It's impossible to process agape when you're, you know, a crusty fisherman. Or no matter what you are. Whether you're an engineer, whether you're a plumber, whether you're a computer scientist, it doesn't matter what you are, you can't process that. So now in verse 1 that you just read, look at this, how he encourages the bride. You know, he tells her over and over again how fair and how beautiful she is. So we're the bride. So he tells us how fair and beautiful we are, and we know that we're not. So how do you react to that? If you say, yeah, I know I'm fair and beautiful, then you're deceiving yourself. Because you're not. Nobody is. Remember in Romans, not one is righteous, not one. It doesn't say, well, most people aren't righteous, but some of them are. It's just not one. So he keeps telling her how beautiful he is. It's repeated twice. And you see there, you have dove's eyes. Your eyes are doves. Remember, doves, no peripheral vision. They can only look forward. It's purity. It's loyalty. Eyes are fixed on whatever they're looking at. If they want to look to the side, they have to turn their whole head. They can't just look with their eyes. So they're fixed. So eyes have to be fixed on him. You have to be like dove's eyes. So now he's saying to the bride, your eyes are like doves. You're fixed on me. You're not looking around to say, well, what about him and what about that? You're fixed on me. And the veil's a sign of humility. You know, so she's humble and fixed on him because now she understands she already lost him once. She doesn't want that to happen again. And she sees this carriage that's coming for her and she's totally blown away because she knows she's not worthy to ride in a gold and silver carriage. You go to heaven, you're going to say, I don't belong here. And now this hair like a flock of goats business. She needs to go to a different beauty parlor. You know, hair's a sign of dedication to God. That's why the Nazarites we learned about in Torah, John the Baptist was the last Nazarite. They never cut their hair. And a razor never touched them. It's a sign of devotion. And, you know, it's about being submissive to God. You let your hair grow, it's a sign that you're submissive. You have a covering over you. And Paul says women are supposed to keep their hair covered when they go to church. Now, this flock of goats, this goes back to Mount Gilead is in this very fertile area where the goats are very well fed and they're fat and they're very healthy. They're like the best goats. Best goats. And so if the way a flock of goats walks, according to Proverbs 30, is that it's very stately. They follow each other up the mountain. And so if you look at them from afar, it looks like they're all like going up the mountain together. So it's like a beautiful thing with these goats. So she's well fed now on him and on the word that he's saying to her. So she's like one of these goats that go up and down Mount Gilead. They're like the coolest goats. So they, when you see them going up and down Mount Gilead, you see, wow, those goats are really cool. That's how he sees her. He says, wow, you're beautiful like those goats. Hope you don't smell like the goats, but you're beautiful like the goats. Then verse 2 is even funnier. Go.
Your teeth are like a flock of ewes to be shorn, which come up from the washing. All of them big with twins, none of them
thin. It's a little bit weird.
Like black to me.
Yeah. So here we go. Now here we got teeth. Now what do you do with teeth? You get your nourishment in, right? You chew. Whether they're your real teeth or you got false teeth or whatever kind of teeth you got, you chew up food so you can nourish yourself with it. If you don't have any teeth at all, it's pretty difficult to, I mean, you can eat some stuff, but it's pretty difficult to eat a lot of stuff. So, the meat represents God's word, what God is telling her, what God is telling us. And the sheep's wool is uneven. That represents fleshly desires. When you shorn a sheep, it all looks horrible. So the sheep still has fleshly desire. That's why, you know, the Bible always talks about us as sheep. Sheep are really stupid. You know, they'll go off by themselves. They'll go over a cliff if they like something that's on the edge of the cliff. The wolf will come. They'll be like, ah, it's a wolf. A sheep can't run. Well, it can't run very well. They have no natural defenses. I mean, the ram does. But the, you know, almost all the sheep in the flock, of course, are ewes. They're ewes. But, you know, a sheep doesn't have any natural defense. They can't do anything to a wolf. Except that they can't even run. They just try to run. They look stupid while they're doing it. So when you shear the sheep, you know, it's kind of like you get rid of the... Well, I should say the wool is uneven, not the shorn sheep. The wool is uneven for their fleshly desire. When they're shorn, that means that they're getting their life under control. They got their flesh under control. And they're coming out of a river, so they've been washed. Now, these people who are listening to Solomon, remember for a long time they didn't know why this book was in the canon. I don't know if Jesus ever explained it to them, because he wouldn't have this book, of course. But they would have understood this coming out of the water, because that's mikvah. You come out of a mikvah bath and you're clean. You know, it's a rough equivalent of baptism. So the sheep are coming out of the river. They've been cleaned now of their worldly desires. And bearing twins is a sign of fruitfulness. Because now they're clean, they're following, and they're going to produce fruit. So they're all going to have twins. They're not just going to have one lamb, they're going to have twins. They're not going to be barren. Because they're following. When we follow, we're not going to be barren. Doesn't mean you're going to have twins. You might not have children at all, but you're going to have fruit. I mean, if somebody's following, if somebody's not bearing fruit, then you have to say, well, is this person really in the fold or not? Because, I mean, what's happening? You know, John the Baptist says the axe goes for the root of the tree that doesn't bear fruit. Chop it down and throw it in the fire. So now that she's on board, he's telling her she's going to be fertile, she's going to be fruitful, she's going to be clean. Okay, now three.
Your lips are like a scarlet ribbon. How lovely they are when you speak. Your cheeks glow behind your veil.
Yeah. So your lips are scarlet. That represents redemption, the blood of redemption. Rahab the prostitute had the red cord, the red strand of salvation. So, it's the blood of the sacrifice. Also, it means the words are good. So, like the words that somebody's saying, who's following, are good words. I mean, somebody who's following the Lord doesn't tell somebody bad words. But, you know, you do edifying speech. So it's a different kind of a mouth than, you know, how in the Revelation it describes the Antichrist as the mouth is always full of curses and blasphemies. It's not a different kind of mouth. It's edifying. It's talk about redemption. It's talk about the Word. It's talk about what the Lord's doing. So it's a good mouth, not a evil mouth. And the cheeks, some translations say temples, that's why I included that. The Hebrew word is actually cheeks, that's what it says in my translation. I don't know what you guys have. But the cheeks show our emotions. Pomegranate, you know, when you blush, you know, your cheeks show, you know, if you're embarrassed, your cheeks get red. If you're happy, your cheeks are, you know, involved in your smile, so forth. So the cheeks help show your emotions. And the pomegranates are sweet. So, you know, you're going to have sweetness coming out of you like a pomegranate. This is why the high priest had the pomegranate on the ephod that they wore. And again, behind the veil is humility. So it's all going to be done in a humble way.
Your neck is like David's tower, girt with battlements, a thousand bucklers hang upon it, all the shields of valiant men. Your breasts are like...
Stop the sound. So the neck refers to free will. Because either you submit Or you keep your neck stiff and you say, I'm doing what I want to do. You remember stiff-necked people? The stiff-necked people. So your neck is either stiff or submissive. Now, the bride's made a choice now to follow him. So she's looking where he's going. So the neck, you know, turns the head. Say, I'm going that way. I'm going this way. I'm not going to go do what I was doing before. So her heart is set on it. David was strong, and he had towers to defend the city. You know, the neck is like a tower. And the bucklers are the little shields that they wore on their arms. They wore little shields, you know, those metal things on their arms were called bucklers. And that's protection from the enemy. It's in Ephesians chapter 6. Paul writes about it. You all know about Ephesians chapter 6. It's all about the helmet of salvation, the breastplate of righteousness. And it has the sword, which is the only offensive weapon. I want to say offensive because it makes it sound like it's bad. But it's the offensive weapon. It says the sword is the word of God. That's what you fight. Like Jesus in the desert, three verses from Deuteronomy and Satan left. The word is like a sword. So it's protection from the enemy. So your neck is like a tower, and you got 1,000 bucklers with shields. So you're protected from the enemy. So you look like a goat. Your teeth are like shorn ewes. You got stuff on your arms. You look horrible, but he likes it. Okay, now verse 5.
Your breasts are like twin fawns, the young of a gazelle that browse among the lilies.
Now, breasts, of course, are for nurturing. That's how a baby's nurtured. So twin fawns is like a double portion. So everything's going to be double. Fruitfulness is increasing now. So she's nurturing others. You see, it's like twins of a gazelle that feed among the lilies. Remember, the lilies were purity and were where she wanted to know where he fed his flocks, and he said in the by the lilies. And so she's fruitful. She's doing double portions. She's nourishing others. The bride's becoming kind of the minister of the covenant. Remember, this is the church we're talking about. The covenant is the covenant we're living in, the covenant of grace that started the day Jesus died. But the church is the minister of it. I mean, he's the minister of it, but, you know, just like Moses was the minister of the old covenant, the covenant of law, you know, Jesus is the minister of, is the mediator of the new covenant, but the bride, the church, we kind of minister the covenant because we spread it to others. So she's bearing fruit now, double portion. So here's the summary. This is the next part of the notes. So you got dove's eyes, single-minded devotion, and revelation following, looking forward. You got hair like goats, which is dedication to God. You got teeth like shorn sheep for chewing the meat of the word. Remember, Paul said, you guys, you know, first you're on milk and then eventually you go on meat. Now I come back here after years and some of you guys are still just living on milk. Because you just want to go to church and say, yeah, it's me and Jesus, I love Jesus, he loves me. But you haven't learned anything. So you're still on milk. You're supposed to advance as you go. You're supposed to be learning as you go. Lips like scarlet are redemptive speech. And also it's the mouth is intimacy with God. The veils are emotions and humility. The neck's like David's tower. And the breasts like fawns are the power to nurture others and build them up. So these are the characteristics he sees. Now he started that whole thing when you read by saying, it says it twice. Behold, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. Remember in Hebrew, when you repeat something, that's big emphasis. Like amen, amen. Verily, verily. Martha, Martha. It's emphasis. Now, you could have just said, Martha, Mary's sitting here and doing the stuff. No, Martha, Martha. You don't get it. I don't care how clean the floor is. She's learning from me, and this is what's important. I don't care what your floor looks like. You know? Or if the meal's not done, who cares? You're supposed to be learning. So when you repeat something, it's emphasis. So she repeats the same thing twice. We have Hosanna, Hosanna. Holy, holy, holy. Well, that's Isaiah 6. Now we're going to get to the interesting thing. Start reading. Somebody read 6. Read 6 and 7.
I will stay on the hill of myrrh, the hill of incense, until the morning breezes blow and the darkness disappears. How beautiful you are, my love. How perfect you are.
You guys have a little different translation.
He says, until the day breathes cool and the shadows lengthen, I will go to the mountain of myrrh for the hill of incense. You will feel it for my life and there is no blemishing.
So now, the bride responds to this. And finally just gives in. Says, you're beautiful, you're beautiful. You have all these characteristics we just mentioned. So now she makes a total commitment. This is the embrace. This is equivalent to embracing the cross. I'll go to the mountain of myrrh. What's myrrh? Yes. It's something that you anoint dead people with. On Sunday morning, that's what they were taken to the tomb. That's what they that's what they anointed dead bodies with, usually right when they died. And then they buried them. But because that was the Sabbath about to start, they had to get the bodies down, put them in the tomb, and then they went back later. But you couldn't do it on the Sabbath, of course. So, it's a burial spice, but it smells really good. Myrrh smells good, but it's a burial spice. So, it's a mountain of myrrh. What does that mean? A lot. There's going to be horrible suffering. It's not a hill of myrrh. It's not a little pile of myrrh. Yeah. So it's a mountain of myrrh is, so it's a mountain of myrrh because the suffering involved, we're talking about the cross, is huge. There's nothing like it. The suffering of Jesus is greater than all the suffering of every human being combined. There's never anything like that. Nor will there be again. It's a mountain of myrrh. It's not a hill. It's not a little pile of myrrh. We'll get to frankincense in a minute. So now she says, I'll go up with you. Now she's embracing the cross. She'll go to the mountain. So Jesus ascends the mountain of myrrh. She says, I will hasten to the mountain of myrrh. So she's going to go with him. She's going to go to the cross. This is her total commitment now to his suffering and to his death. Because now she understands what's going on. See, now she's gotten way more mature than she was a chapter ago. She'll go. This is total commitment. This is when you go to the cross, you understand that you can't do this yourself. You know, in Galatians, I think it's 4. What is it, 5? I think it's 4. It says, the law is a schoolmaster that drives you to the cross. And once you're at the cross, you don't need the schoolmaster anymore. Because you say, I can't do this law, I can't do this law. Oh, it's so frustrating, I sinned again, I fell again. So you go to the cross and say, I can't. Schoolmaster drives you to the cross. Some translations call it a taskmaster. Then once you get to the cross, you say, I don't need the taskmaster anymore now. So she's, I'll go on the mountain of myrrh. So she's going to deny herself. Our response to that is we deny ourselves and we follow, right? We can't do the mountain of myrrh like he did. Nobody's ever going to do that, ever. But we understand it, and we can deny ourselves and say we're going to take part in that. You know, Paul says, I can share in the sufferings of Christ. You can't know what the sufferings of Christ felt like, but you can share in it. So, frankincense refers to prayers. Remember, frankincense was, they brought frankincense because it was a sign of praise, and it was a sign, you know, the incense in the temple rose up like prayers rising to heaven. Plus it covered the smell of what was actually going on there, but, you know, their prayers rising up. And it's smaller than the mountain of myrrh because we can't match up to the suffering. Nobody can match up to it. Our prayers are at a much lower level than what he did. So Jesus tells Peter to pray because temptation is coming. You know, pray that you can be spared from this. And the other thing, too, is that even though the hill is a lot smaller than the mountain, the prayer is smaller than the suffering. The prayer is important. And a small amount of prayer does a lot of things. It's not going to match up to the suffering of myrrh. Because that's the cross. You all saw the Passion of the Christ, right? And now, see, the bride's made a decision. I will hasten to the mountain of myrrh. So I'm going to go with you. This is her total commitment now. It's radical obedience. Because now she embraces his death and embraces the cross, embraces the suffering. So this is radical. She makes a decision. So she wants to be with the one who loves her. He's always saying, I love you, you're fair, you're beautiful. She goes, I'm going to be with you. I don't ever want you to disappear again. So, you know, we all have that path toward the mountain of myrrh. We all are involved with that. I mean, that's the whole point of Christianity. We've made Christianity nice and clean. You got the church picnic, you have this church chicken dinner, you know, you go to the ball game together. That's nice. That's not Christianity. You help the homeless guy, that's nice. But you gotta embrace suffering, you have to go to the cross. The gospel's not go and be nice. That's part of the gospel. But the cross is the center. Then he goes back to, you are all fair, my love. There was no flaw in you. So she responds to him. He says, oh, you're beautiful. There's no flaws in you. Remember, she's got a lot of flaws. We got a lot of flaws. The Trinity will be in heaven and he'll say, there's no flaw in you. And you'll say, there is. Don't you remember all the stuff I did? But it's all going to be covered up. We're stopping there because now we get into the garden stuff, which is a whole other lesson. So, it's a new day. See, it goes back to a new day is going to breathe and shadows are going to flee. You know, shadows are compromises and weaknesses and things that get in your way. They're going to flee. A new day is now. You're embracing the cross, you're embracing the suffering, and now your whole life is different. And all that shadows and stuff is still going to come. You're still going to have dark nights of the soul, and you're still going to have all that other stuff. But it's going to be different because it's not going to be a hopeless thing. It's not going to dominate your life. It's not going to lead to your destruction, hopefully. You know, he doesn't see, you know, if you've got a person who's been, say, physically sick for a long period of time and is all wasted away, you know, Jesus doesn't look at you and say, oh man, you know, you're so sick and wasted away and you're so weak. You can't do anything now. He says, you're beautiful. You don't have any flaws. And again, you know, I always use the example of go to Beverly Hills on a beautiful sunny Saturday afternoon and see all those people with the clothes and the sports cars and the mansions and tell them that they're living in darkness and that they'll think you're a kook. We're beautiful people. The sun's out. I got all this cool stuff. What are you talking about? So now we've gotten about a little more. We're about halfway through the book. So the bride's already changed from being kind of giddy and immature. And now she embraces the cross and says, I'm going to do what you want me to do. So she's gone from milk to meat.